What did you want to be when you grew up? How often did you change your mind? Did you grow up to be the thing you said you wanted to be? What if what you wanted to be when you grew up was just disappeared? Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. I know what it's like to get to be what I wanted to be growing up. For the majority of us, we wanted to be firefighters or dolphin doctors or unicorns. But as we grew up, reality beat those dreams right out of us when we learned that firefighting is dangerous, dolphin doctor school was too expensive, and the world only has room for one unicorn, and that role is already taken by Janelle Monáe. But for precocious children, who get the opportunity to live out their dreams while they're still young, sometimes talent can feel like a trap. Imagine a 5-year-old who's somehow innately good at treating dolphin diseases, and the world celebrates them as a dolphin doctor prodigy. But by 18, the kid is like, maybe I want to do something else now? But now they feel trapped because everyone knows them as the dolphin doctor, and if they switch to some other profession, somehow they've let not just the dolphins down, but everyone else who so enjoyed following their exploits as the world's youngest dolphin doctor. Besides, they've spent so much time being a dolphin doctor that they kind of miss the boat on learning a lot of fundamentals, and switching course now would be too time-consuming, so they just stick with being a dolphin doctor. But year after year, they grow more and more disillusioned with doctoring dolphins. And besides, they're getting older now, and it's less novel, and people are less impressed because any adult can be a dolphin doctor. Doogie Howser was only cool because he was so young. You know what I mean? And despite that whole intro, stranger, today's episode has nothing to do with dolphins. Barbara Newhall Follett was a genius from a very young age. That is, at least according to her parents, who really did seem to think the sun shone out of her diapers from the word go. She was born in 1914 in New Hampshire to Helen and Wilson Follett. Helen and Wilson were both literary types. Helen was a writer, and Wilson worked as a professor of literature at Brown and Yale before being hired as an editor at Knopf in the Young Publishing House in New York City. Barbara was taught at home by her parents, who claimed she could read and knew her numbers from a very young age. Her father liked to tell anyone who would listen that Barbara became interested in his typewriter at the age of 3. Her mother would later put that number closer to 5, and some accounts put it at 4. Whatever the case, she was extremely young when she started messing with her dad's typewriter, composing letters, short stories, and poems, and according to a biography on Barbara on the website Farxolia, all about Barbara and her life and work, she wrote the following letter when she was only 5 years old. Quote, "The goldfinches come every afternoon and eat their supper on the clump of bachelor's buttons right on the left-hand side of the path that leads from the back door to our road. There are 10 goldfinches, 5 males and 5 females. Before they eat their supper, they sit on the clothesline and swing in the breeze. I wish you could be here to see them. Day before yesterday, Daddy killed a snake in the potato patch. Then he threw the snake away with a stick. Then he threw away the stick." The next day, Ding, Barbara's grandmother on her mother's side who lived with the family, and I went down Ridgeview Place, and there were the snake and the stick. The snake was about 3 feet long, end quote. Her father explained that Barbara was able to make the compositions not only because she knew how to read and write from such a young age, but also because the typewriter facilitated her writing before she had the dexterity needed to write by hand. His contribution, he assured, was only as editor and spell checker. By the time she was 6, she had written a 4,500-word short story about her stuffed rabbit, stuffed horse, and an anthropomorphized spinning wheel. She was, at this point, it is said, writing upwards of 4,000 words a day, which, I can tell you, as someone who writes for a living, is a lot of words. Then again, she didn't have memes of dogs wearing Chucky costumes to distract her, or a podcast where she recapped Love is Blind, so to be fair, she had a lot more time than some of us. On the other hand, unlike some of us, Barbara was also inventing an entire language to go along with the world of Farsukia she was inventing. At 7, she wrote this, quote, "In a chapter called Springtime, I have written down a little poem in a secret language that Verbeny calls Farksu. In the secret language, it was this. Arpeen Mabers Barge Kraku, Peen Yars Fis Farled Cray Pern, Peen Darn Dian Flar Fulus Lart Ain Bird Dream, A Fee Lart Ain Kareen Ien Tu Crestine Der Tui, Darn Keen Crake Peen Boon." I will now translate it as best I can. "As the," and Mabers means a flower that comes in May, "begin to come, the air is filled with perfume. The dandelion fluff floats like a," and bird dream means something very beautiful, "also like a fairy in her dress of gold, dancing to the wind," end quote. According to Farksolia.org, quote, "her Farksu lexicon, complete with syntax and conjugated verbs, would soon occupy 2-card catalog files, one for the Farksu to English, and the other English to Farksu." Barbara worked on Farksu at least into 1933, when she asked her mother to bring a particular notebook with her to Germany, end quote. It may not come as much of a shock that Barbara didn't have a lot of friends. First, there was the homeschooling, and second, there was a precociousness that I'm sure made it very hard to relate to other 7-year-olds who were picking their noses and eating mud pies and whatever else kids did back then. Plus, Barbara was really good with boundaries. When she was 8, she wrote this note and taped it to her door. Quote, "Nobody may come into this room if the door is shut tight. If it is shut not quite latched, it is all right, without knocking. The person in this room, if he agrees that one shall come in, will say, 'Come in,' or something like that. And if he does not agree to it, he will say, 'Not yet, please,' or something like that. The door may be shut if nobody is in the room, but if a person wants to come in, knocks, and hears no answer, that means there is no one in the room and he must not go in. Reason: if the door is shut tight and a person is in the room, the shut door means that the person in the room wishes to be left alone," end quote. Not sure why she referred to herself with the masculine pronoun. And when one of her young friends didn't respect her boundary, she sent her a note that included this, quote, "You don't understand why I have my work to do, because at this particular time, you have none at all," end quote. Okay, geez. But Barbara's demand for privacy really paid off. It took a number of years of drafting and rewriting, once losing her only copy of the manuscript in a house fire and having to start over. But in 1927, when she was just 12 years old, Barbara's first book, A House Without Windows, was published by Knopf. And if you hear yourself thinking, wait, wasn't that the publishing house her dad worked at? Congratulations, you're keeping good score. But let's hold that thought for a minute. A House Without Windows centered around a young girl named Ypersip, who ran away from loneliness and found a community of animal friends in the woods. Ypersip attempts to lure other children into the woods with her, eludes her parents, who never stop looking for her, and eventually transforms herself into a wood nymph. The book was a huge success. According to her biography on Farksolia.org, quote, "the first printing of 2,500 had sold out before the publication date, and a second printing of it was immediately ordered," end quote. Critics mostly raved about the book. In a review titled A Mirror of the Child Mind, the New York Times cooed that the book was, quote, "the most authentic and unalloyed document of a transient and hitherto unrecorded phase in plastic intelligence. A truly remarkable little book," end quote. The Saturday Review of Literature declared it was almost unbearably beautiful. But while most were beguiled by Barbara and her extraordinary work, Anne Carroll Moore, the creator of the children's room in the New York City Public Library, wrote this for the New York Herald Tribune, quote, "I can conceive of no greater handicap for the writer between the ages of 19 and 39 than to have published a successful book between the age of 9 and 12. I have only words of praise for the story itself. The House Without Windows is exquisite, but it is playing with fire. What price will Barbara have to pay for her big days at the typewriter? There are no satisfactions comparable to a free and spacious childhood with a clear title to one's own good name at maturity. End quote. In other words, the worst thing for an adult writer's career is to have had a successful writing career as a child. Children should be children, not professionals. Barbara did not agree. She responded to Moore with a letter that, according to a piece by Paul Collins for Lampham's Quarterly, read in part, quote, "It is surely very rash to slam down into the mud a childhood and a system of living that you know nothing about. I am very much amused at the favorable reviews which are being written. I do not take them at all seriously. But I do take seriously an article which distorts into a miserable caricature my living, my education, my whole personality. To read her book as if I were tyrannized over, Barbara wrote, insulted her and her parents. The book, she insisted, is an expression of joy, no more." End quote. I mean, I don't know that Moore slammed Barbara's childhood and system of living, whatever that means, in the mud for expressing her concern with Barbara's well-being, but one can hardly blame a 12-year-old for being defensive, I suppose, especially not one as apparently articulate as Barbara. If, indeed, these were Barbara's own words. Strangers, have you checked out Wildgrain yet? Listen, if you're into bread, pasta, and pastries, even if you're gluten-free or vegan, you have to see what Wildgrain has to offer. Last weekend, my kid had a friend over, and I popped Wildgrain's huge chocolate chunk cookies into the oven, and 20 minutes later, they had warm, fresh-baked cookies, and I was a hero. Wildgrain's pastas cook in less than 5 minutes and pair perfectly with Wildgrain's delicious pasta sauces. If you're looking for unbelievable breakfast biscuits or waffles, you have to check out Wildgrain. Unlike store-bought, Wildgrain uses a slow fermentation process that's easier on your belly, richer in nutrients and antioxidants, and made with simple ingredients you can pronounce. Each box is fully customizable, and they're constantly adding seasonal and limited-time products for you to enjoy. Plus, everything bakes in under 25 minutes. This fall, treat yourself and your loved ones to warm sourdough breads and seasonal baked goods from Wildgrain. Rumor has it, they have apple cider donuts and pumpkin cinnamon biscuits, so get them before these seasonal items sell out. For a limited time, Wildgrain is offering our listeners $30 off the first box, plus free croissants in every box when you go to wildgrain.com/strange to start your subscription. You heard me, free croissants in every box and $30 off your first box when you go to wildgrain.com/strange. That's wildgrain.com/strange, or you can use promo code STRANGE at checkout. Don't miss their seasonal products. So what does a young, accomplished prodigy do after having their first novel published to rave reviews? Why, they become a crew member on a ship and sail away. When Barbara was only 13 years old, she somehow befriended the captain and crew of a lumber schooner, and then, according to Farxolia.org, she demanded that her parents let her go on their next journey. Her parents apparently had requirements, but the biography doesn't elaborate on what those requirements were. I would hope, at the very least, one requirement was that she wear a pair of iron underwear with a padlock on it. Quote, "Finally, the captain agreed and a chaperone was found. Barbara spent 10 glorious days in June befriending the crew, working in the galley, and helping her favorite mate, Bill, with his chores." End quote. I am so uncomfortable with all of this. Who was the chaperone? Why did her mother not go with her? Who lets a 13-year-old girl get on a boat with a bunch of men and just sail off? When I was 12, I was cast in a TV show, but my mom was sick, so neither she nor my dad could accompany me to Los Angeles, and they weren't about to send their child to LA with some chaperone. Those of you who have 13-year-old daughters, would you let them just get on a ship with a bunch of sailors and be like, "Don't forget to brush your teeth"? Especially considering Barbara had spent so much time with adults and was clearly old for her years. I'm sure she considered herself an adult. Yuck. I don't want to think about it. Fortunately, as far as we know, anyway, nothing untoward happened to Barbara on that ship, though I'm not sure I buy it. In addition to helping out with chores while on board, Barbara gathered inspiration for her second book, The Voyage of the Normandy. According to the piece in Laffam's Quarterly, quote, the voyage took place in July, the final manuscript was in Knopf's hand by November, and the book was in stores by March, end quote. That is, it should go without saying, lightning speed in the world of writing and publishing. It was published just 12 days before her 14th birthday. This book was also met with glowing reviews. The London Times Literary Supplement said, quote, its ingeniousness is preserved, yet embellished, by a literary craftsmanship which would do credit to an experienced writer, end quote. The publication of The Voyage of the Normandy firmly established Barbara as a writer and not just a novelty child act. But the book's reception was overshadowed by her beloved father Wilson's announcement that he was leaving the family for his much younger secretary. Jesus, it's so tacky. Like, if you're gonna be a piece of shit, at least have the decency to not also be such a cliché. Anyway, Barbara was devastated. Not only was her father, well, her father, but he'd also been a huge champion of her writing. Her first editor, and not for nothing, the steady breadwinner for the family, who by this time had increased by one with the addition of a little sister named Sabra. Barbara wrote to him begging him to come home, to which he'd apparently responded that his new girlfriend Helen, quote, needed him, to which Barbara replied basically, yeah, dude, I need you too. But, you know, much more gracefully than that. Without a steady income, according to Farxolia, quote, she persuaded her mother that an adventure at sea was their best recourse, and Harper and Brothers was keen to publish her writing about it. And so, leaving young Sabra in the care of a guardian, they sailed from New York to Barbados in September 1928. From there, with no itinerary in mind, nor any idea when they might return, with few belongings, a suitcase and two portable typewriters, and very little money, Helen expected Wilson to support them while they were away, but no money ever came, they explored Caribbean islands for several months, end quote. But you know what they say, wherever you go, there you are. It seems no matter how far the pair traveled, Barbara was haunted by the sudden departure of her father. In a letter from that time, her mother wrote, quote, Barbara has gone to pieces. Her writing job is not anywhere near finished. She has lost interest in things, in living, in writing. She says herself that she is homesick. She is in critical condition and likely to do anything from running away to suicide. And my advice is not what she wants. She must have a man to help her, end quote. Be careful what you wish for, parents. On the ride home to the States, Barbara, then 15 years old, developed a close relationship with a sailor named Anderson, who was 10 years her senior. And despite Barbara's mother Helen being worried that Barbara might be suicidal, when they made port in Los Angeles, Helen was like, bye, and left Barbara with some family friends while she went off to Hawaii to begin work on the first of two novels she would write about her time at sea with Barbara. Barbara enrolled at Pasadena Junior College. It was her first time in a formal education setting. She also began seeing a psychiatrist named Tour Schultz, and by seeing, I think, they mean in a doctor-patient relationship. However, according to Farxolia, Schultz, quote, in reality, was not a psychiatrist, but a sometime masseur with a history of fraud, including his claim to be a Swedish count. Alarmingly, Schultz had been convicted 10 years earlier in Tennessee for attempt to violate the age of consent and by offering indecent exposures and proposals to high school girls. Whether or not he made any advances toward Barbara, I don't know, end quote. Yeah, I hate it too, stranger. So Barbara, with no real experience around people her age, none in a classroom setting, and with a string of older men and questionable relationships behind her, ran away to San Francisco. Her guardians filed a missing persons report, and somehow police tracked Barbara down to a hotel where she was hiding out and working on her next novel. When police burst into her hotel room, Barbara jumped out the window. Whether this was an escape or a suicide attempt, no one knows. But she failed at either escaping or killing herself and was instead met with hounding national press coverage. The Illinois Daily Register Gazette ran a story with the headline, "Girl Writer 15 Tries Suicide to Cheat Law." And the Fresno Bee ran a piece with the headline, "Girl Novelist Ran Away to Avoid School." Quote, "All her life, Barbara Follett has had freedom and independence. Her education has all been individual, and she has never gone to school." "They had planned to send me to Pasadena Junior College," explained Barbara, who has all the poise and intelligence of a woman twice her age. "I can't stand school, and I detest Los Angeles. It takes all the spirit out of me in that heat. I love San Francisco, so I just packed my baggage, left a note, and came up here. Oh, what a glorious time I've had these days. I've been alone all the time and free. I can't do any writing if I'm hedged about by restrictions all the time. If I can't be free until I'm 21, I can do no writing until then." End quote. For someone who was used to being in the public eye for her talent, this could not have felt great. Strangers, are you feeling stuck in your daily wellness routine? You're not alone. Our friends at Cornbread Hemp hear you. Their organic CBD gummies are made to help you feel better, whether it's stress, poor sleep, or just needing a moment to unwind. CBD might be just what you need to level up your daily routine. Cornbread Hemp uses only the best part of the hemp plant, the flower, for the purest and most potent CBD. No fillers, no junk, just full-spectrum goodness. I love that all their products are third-party lab-tested and USDA organic to ensure safety and purity. I love their sleep gummies, but Cornbread Hemp has a whole line of hemp and THC products for whatever you're looking to address. Right now, Strange and Unexplained listeners can save 30% on their first order. Just head to cornbreadhemp.com/strange and use code STRANGE at checkout. That's cornbreadhemp.com/strange and use code STRANGE. Her parents arrived and duked it out in court for custody, but the judge ultimately gave Barbara the choice. She chose to live with her mother, most likely because her father had already fucking abandoned her once, but also because apparently Barbara was still seeing the 25-year-old Anderson from the ship, and her dad didn't like that. Which is absolutely the appropriate response to a 25-year-old dating a 15-year-old, but also, at the same time, like, you don't have tremendous ground to stand on when you left your family for a woman 20 years your junior. Granted, his girlfriend was not a teenager, but still. Anyway, Barbara and her mother Helen, and I assume her little sister Sabra, though she's hardly mentioned anywhere, moved to New York City. It was just after the stock market crash, and times were tough. The former child genius, whose prose had knocked the socks off critics all over the world, was reduced to working as a secretary, which, while placing her in front of a typewriter, she remarked was a, quote, decidedly more tawdry use of its magic. By June of that year, toiling away as a secretary in New York City, the once famous child author wrote, quote, "My dreams are going through their death flurries. I thought they were all safely buried, but sometimes they stir in their grave, making my heartstrings twinge. I mean no particular dream, you understand, but the whole radiant flock of them together, with their rainbow wings, iridescent, bright, soaring, glorious, sublime. They are dying before the steel javelins and arrows of a world of time and money," end quote. Listen, as a native New Yorker, let me tell you, New York has that effect on people. Sometimes, though, misery makes for great inspiration, and it was at this time that Barbara began work on her third book. This one, titled Lost Island, combined themes from her first two novels as well as her own experiences. The novel's protagonist, Jane, a young secretary working in New York City, talks her way onto a lumber schooner where she falls in love with one of the sailors. The ship wrecks and the pair find themselves on a deserted island that's basically paradise. But they're forced to return to New York, where Jane is back where she started and contemplating running away all over again. She ends Lost Island with this, quote, "Jane laughed again, but there was a gleam of danger in her eye. Sometime, not too far off, she would stage another rebellion. It would not be the same kind of rebellion, though. One could never repeat the real adventures. That was why so many people were unhappy," she reflected. "They tried to go back and repeat the things that had made them happy before. They tried to retrace the trail and visit again the places where they had known their highest ecstasies. Whereas if only they had the courage to push on, forward, over deserts and swamps and glaciers, they would sometimes make new discoveries as bright as the others, or even brighter, perhaps. One good way to start a rebellion was to buy a red, red skirt," end quote. Clearly, Barbara had an insatiable desire to escape, but it seems to me that with the red, red skirt, she wanted desperately to be seen. Of course, there aren't enough red skirts in the world to fix a hole in the heart. In 1931, Barbara met a man named Nick Rogers, who it seemed shared Barbara's spirit for adventure. The pair hiked the Appalachian Trail beginning the following summer, and then backpacked through Europe, finally returning to the States to settle in Boston, where they married in July of 1934 when Barbara was 20. Barbara wrote her fourth and final manuscript, Travels Without a Donkey, about hiking the Appalachian Trail. But according to Laffam's Quarterly, quote, "worn down by 6 years without the encouragement of a father or an editor, the manuscripts finally stopped," end quote. And by 1937, she wrote to a friend, quote, "I had one or two fairly high adventures and am convinced that they are worth all kinds of sweat and pain and other troubles. In fact, they are the only things really worth suffering for. My greatest worry now, when I have time to stop and think about it, is that I am in a rather difficult position as far as adventure is concerned, where that evasive spirit may have trouble locating me. Life right now is a very quiet adventure, though pleasant at that," end quote. But the spirit did manage to locate her, and she left for a road trip across the country with some friends. Nick's work kept him too busy to travel, and he was apparently upset with Barbara for traveling without him, because, of course. On August 9th, while still on her summer trip with friends, Barbara received a letter from Nick asking for a divorce. While he made no mention of another woman, Barbara was convinced he was having an affair. She took a bus back to Boston, where she found the apartment she shared with Nick emptied of all his stuff. She desperately tried to find him, but couldn't, and apparently was in such a state that she called a doctor. She wrote to a friend, quote, "he came right over to me bringing A, three large, juicy, and delectable hamburgers, B, a bottle of whiskey, and C, some sleeping dope. Well, the combination of those things, plus a good talk with him, just fixed me up. I slept well and woke up yesterday quite relaxed and almost confident and hopeful. I spent the day very slowly and quietly doing domestic things, and time passed fairly quickly. I read and listened to the radio and got to sleep last night under my own power, without benefit of dope," end quote. Nick found his balls and returned home, and the pair took a trip to Vermont, perhaps to try to repair their marriage. She found out there was indeed another woman, because of course there was, and in a letter to a friend, she said it was her fault for driving him away with her need for travel, which was, of course, what the pair had bonded over in the first place. Barbara begged Nick for another chance, to which he basically replied, "Okay, but don't get your hopes up." By November, she told her friend that things in her marriage, quote, "continued to go well for a time, at least I thought so, and I was happy and decided that the worst part of the ordeal was over. But that was too easy. No such luck. I don't know what to say now. On the surface, things are terribly, terribly calm and wrong, just as wrong as they can be. I am trying. We are both trying. I still think there is a chance that the outcome will be a happy one. But I would have to think that anyway in order to live, so you can draw any conclusions you like from that," end quote. And then, just 2 months later, on December 7th, after a fight with Nick, Barbara left their home with $30 in her pocket and never came back. Strangers, you know how important I think therapy is, but these days it can feel impossible to find a therapist. Between finding a good therapist, scheduling appointments, and expensive out-of-pocket costs, many are still not getting the care they need. But Rula is on a mission to make high-quality mental health care from a licensed professional easy and affordable for everyone. Rula takes most major insurance plans, and the average copay is only $15 per session. But Rula is not just affordable. They stick with you throughout your journey, making sure you get the best therapy and that you're making progress. With Rula, every provider is carefully vetted and chosen for their expertise. You'll always know you're in the hands of quality providers who are dedicated to making real progress in your care. Listen, life is particularly hard these days. You shouldn't be doing it alone. And Rula makes it easier than ever to find a licensed professional to help you through your journey. Thousands have already trusted Rula to support them on their journey toward improved mental health and overall well-being. Head on over to rula.com/strange to get started today. After you sign up, they ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them our show sent you. Go to rula.com/strange and take the first step towards better mental health today. You deserve quality care from someone who cares. For some reason, it took Nick 2 weeks to report his wife missing. There was no one in the morgue who matched her description. However, according to Farxolia, quote, initially, Nick declined the police's offer to publicize the case, which isn't surprising given Barbara's history with the press, particularly when she ran away in 1929, end quote. I mean, yeah, but she's your wife, and don't you want to find her? It wasn't until April of the following year that Nick agreed to release the report. It read, quote, missing from Brookline since December 7th, 1939, Barbara Rogers, married, age 26, 5'7", 125, fair complexion, black eyebrows, brown eyes, dark auburn hair worn in a long bob, left shoulder slightly higher than right, occasionally wears horn-rim glasses, end quote. Barbara Rogers? Who's that? To quote Mariah Carey, I don't know her. In fact, it wasn't until 1966, 27 years after she went missing, that the world even knew Barbara Follett was missing. And then it was only because her mother co-authored what Latham's Quarterly described as a slim academic study on her daughter. It was 13 years before that, in 1952, however, that Helen told the Brookline police that foul play should always be considered in the case of a wife mysteriously going missing. And to Nick, she said, quote, all of this silence on your part looks as if you had something to hide concerning Barbara's disappearance. You cannot believe that I shall sit idle during my last few years and not make whatever effort I can to find out whether Bar is alive or dead, whether perhaps she is in some institution suffering from amnesia or nervous breakdown, end quote. At this, Nick hired a private investigator to look into his wife's disappearance. That proved fruitless, because of course it did, because what was he going to find 13 years after the woman went missing? For some reason, Nick was never considered a suspect, though according to Barbara's nephew, Stefan Cook, who runs the Farxolia website, there wasn't enough evidence to implicate him. Of course, a lack of evidence isn't proof of innocence, but regardless, no one except Helen, perhaps, thought Nick had anything to do with his wife's disappearance. The couple rented a lake house in the mountains near Squam Lake, and it's unknown if anyone bothered looking up there for her. A lot of the records concerning Barbara's disappearance have been lost to time. One kind of has to assume they searched the lake house. But in 1948, a hunter came across human remains near Squam Lake with a few personal effects, including a small medicine flask, which was later found to have traces of a barbiturate in it. Most of the skeleton had been scavenged away, but what did remain was sent to Boston for examination. The doctor concluded, however, that the bones belonged to another young woman, Elise Whitemore, who had gone missing from Plymouth in 1936. But conditions suggested the body had only been in the spot for about 8 years, which would have matched with Barbara's disappearance more than Elise's, unless Elise had managed to stay alive for 3 years before dying in that spot in the mountains. I mean, Plymouth is only about 5 miles from where the remains were found, so I guess it's possible. Elise's family, however, refused to accept the findings. According to Farxolia, quote, "Shoes found on the body were a size 7, Elise wore a size 5 or 5.5. None of the belongings found on the body were recognizable to Elise's family. Moritz used Krogman's table to estimate the woman's height at only 62 or 63 inches, shorter than Barbara's 5'7", but Krogman's table has been superseded. Today, the length of the found tibia puts the height at Barbara's 67 inches," end quote. Now, imagine if the press had known about Barbara's disappearance in 1948. Maybe the hunter's discovery of remains might have sparked some coverage and gotten some questions answered. And now, because so many records were lost, people don't even have a solid idea of where the house she and Nick were renting even was. People don't even know where the remains were found anymore. Oh, also, no one knows where the remains even are anymore. That's right, those were lost as well. Obviously, if they still existed, Barbara's nephew could use them to compare his DNA to, and we could get an answer. What happened to Barbara after she walked out of her home on December 7th, 1939, and seemingly blooped off the face of the earth isn't the only open-ended question about Barbara's life. While there have been cases of real savant children, there are some things about Barbara's story that strike me as implausible. Her father's insistence that the typewriter was the key to opening the door to Barbara's talent is a little squishy, in my opinion. His argument was that the barrier to her written expression was not language, but lacking the fine motor skills to put pen to paper. But have you ever tried to use a typewriter from the olden days? The force with which you have to hit the keys to actually make a mark on the paper is pretty significant, and it's hard to imagine a child as young as 3 achieving it. Her mother insisted Barbara was actually 5 when she began using the typewriter, but that makes no difference as far as I'm concerned. Barbara's parents seemed convinced of her brilliance almost immediately. Wilson would apparently write letters to friends recounting even the most mundane things Barbara did. Also, he admits openly that he was Barbara's editor, and who knows what that really means. Was he fixing syntax and grammar, or was he rewriting stories his daughter relayed to him? According to a piece about Barbara's first book, A House Without Windows, on the blog The Literary Sisters, quote, "Newhall Follett's descriptions are both perceptive and beautiful, and it is sometimes difficult to believe that they were written by someone so young." A corner of Eaparsip's garden, for instance, is, quote, "carpeted with tender anemones, all snow white, and the paths through the garden had gracefully bending ferns on each side," end quote. Eaparsip's asides are quite lovely, too. Quote, "Dawn comes to earth sometimes," she thought, "bringing her flower clouds and clasping them with pearl seeds," end quote. Again, I've heard of precocious children, but "dawn comes to earth sometimes, bringing her flower clouds and clasping them with pearl seeds"? Unless she was the Mozart of prose, this is a little hard to get on board with. I'm more likely to believe she said something like, "when the sun comes up, it brings clouds made of flowers and pearls," and her dad was like, "got it," and turned it into the other thing. Hey, strangers, you have got to check out The Void, the brand new immersive fiction podcast produced by Fable and Folly. In the town of Milton, the darkness isn't just in your head. It lives in the woods. They call it The Void, a cursed expanse that surrounds the town, swallowing anyone who dares to leave. When an eccentric old man shares a strange pamphlet, a whispered promise of a path through the void, a group of friends begin a harrowing journey that will change everything they knew about their town, their families, and themselves. With cinematic sound design and talented voice cast, this horror sci-fi audio drama is perfect for fans of Stranger Things and Super 8. So follow The Void on your favorite podcast app and step carefully. It bears pointing out that Barbara's output pretty much stopped once Wilson abandoned the family. Of course, that could have come from any number of things, but it's hard to not notice the timing. For a writer as seemingly prolific as Barbara, it's hard to imagine she just stopped writing when her dad left. Then again, if Barbara, with Wilson's heavy hand, was the cash cow of the family, it's hard to imagine Wilson would have just walked away from that income source. His much younger secretary must have been quite something for him to leave all that potential money behind. I don't mean to besmirch Barbara's name. It seems to me she was remarkably talented with words either way. Who's to say what any child could achieve given the right amount of support and encouragement? But then again, at what cost? As vehemently as Barbara, or perhaps her father/proxy, rejected the warning that critic Anne Carroll Moore made after The House Without Windows came out, perhaps she might have been wise to take heed. While it is true that Moore didn't know much about Barbara's particular childhood or her so-called system of living, she had a fairly well-rounded knowledge of children and of writing as a profession in general, and I don't think she was too far out of line with her criticism. Her concern that Barbara's breakout success might overshadow her career as a writer was fair and, ultimately, perhaps correct. The expectations placed on a young person with talent can become an albatross. There is the anticipation of more great and even better work, which for any writer can produce profound writer's block, but can feel insurmountable to a child. I would imagine that no matter how long she'd lived and how many stories she'd published, the specter of her childhood fame would always hang above her. A talented child is a novelty. A talented adult is relatively mundane in comparison. I wonder how much of that weighed on Barbara. Also, there is the possibility that the child prodigy might, like any normal child, find new things to occupy their time and lose interest in the thing they're known for. After all, how many of us still want to actually be the thing we said we wanted to be when we grew up? Kids need to be able to change their minds, pick up and put down new hobbies and interests, figure out what fits and what doesn't. One minute it might be writing, the next it might be dressing up like a fairy princess mermaid. But when you are an accomplished author by the age of 12, you can't just turn around and be like, actually, today I want to be a firefighter, you know? And then there's the isolation that comes with holding oneself up at one's typewriter for hours on end, while one's peers are out playing stickball or hopscotch. When Barbara dismissed her young friend as having no work at all to do, she was discounting the very real and important work of just being a child. Even with all the support and encouragement her parents gave her, it seems to me their efforts were a bit misguided. Who sends a 13-year-old girl out to sea with a bunch of sailors? And perhaps there were important developmental milestones she missed out on with not having a regular childhood. Like I said before, the work of childhood may not look like work, but it's vital nonetheless. Maybe Barbara was less equipped to handle the realities of adulthood because she'd missed important lessons in childhood. And as idyllic as Barbara's childhood is portrayed, let's not forget that her breakout success was a book about a young girl who runs away into the woods and hates civilization so much she turns herself into a nymph. She spends a good portion of the book running away and hiding from her own parents who desperately search for her. For someone who was having such an incredible childhood, what was Barbara wanting to run away from? The protagonist in her second-to-last book, Lost Island, finds herself stranded on a perfect desert island with a man she loves, only to be forced back into the gray, reigning reality of a secretary's life in New York City, and ends with her veiled threat to change her life dramatically again, this time perhaps disappearing into the identity of a person who might wear a red, red skirt. Barbara's inner world and her real life were filled with adventure and escape until, I suppose, it wasn't. When she found herself stuck in a floundering marriage, perhaps without the emotional resources to work through it, and with the ever-present desire to run away and disappear, she chose the latter. It's probable that Barbara walked out of her unhappy life into the woods she so loved, took a lethal dose of something, and died. In the comment section of the Farxolia biography, some have suggested that perhaps Barbara adopted a new identity and lived out a life as someone else, maybe even continuing to write under a pseudonym. One reader suggested she might have cut her hair and passed herself off as a man and joined the Navy in the war effort. There's no way to know for sure. I like to think that Barbara's life ended the way her book, The House Without Windows, did. Quote, "She would be invisible forever to all mortals, save those few who have minds to believe, eyes to see. To these, she is ever present, a spirit of nature, a sprite of the meadow, a naiad of lakes, a nymph of the woods." End quote. Next time on Strange and Unexplained, we'll take a trip to one of the most listener-requested areas, Doll Island. This episode was written by me, Daisy Egan, with research by Joe Gradet, sound engineering by Jeff Devine, music by Epidemic and Blue Dot Sessions. If you have an idea for an episode, head to our website, strangeandunexplainedpod.com, and fill out the contact form. I will write back. Grab Bag is an all-female and non-binary-owned profit-share network where our contributors get to keep ownership of their shows. We strive to give a platform to those who might not be able to land themselves on a bigger network. Who knows? Maybe you have a podcast idea you'd like to pitch to Grab Bag. We've got live recordings, watch parties, book clubs, and more. Why there's so much going on over at Grab Bag, you'll wonder if we missed the memo on how capitalism works. Join me on Instagram at SNUPod, Daisy Egan, and Grab Bag Collab. Or head to the Facebook page to join in the conversation. If you like the show, please visit a sponsor with our unique code, give us a quick review and 5 stars, subscribe and download, and tell a friend. Stay strange.